So I'm going to be talking about some work I've been doing with Salman Habib and Emil Matola on inhomogeneous fields out of equilibrium. As Grant was pointing out, that's a pretty ambitious title, and part of the reason for me giving that grand title was that, in addition to the technical details which I plan to discuss, I want to spend a little bit of time, in the introduction and motivation part, sort of putting our work in perspective in a more general context, and also, so then I'll go through the technical parts of the talk, which is look at the evolution equations for a very simple model given the grand title, but even so, I mean, the point is that our goal is to sort of view this as a first step in a series of steps that we would like to take. And the reason for choosing the simple model in a simple setting is really that we want to understand the physics, all the relevant issues in the context of the simple model, and then go to more complicated models in higher dimensions and make some progress there once we understand what the simple model is telling us. So after I have the evolution equations, I will go to the renormalization. And then, again, partly with a view to future, I'll make an ansatz to simplify the numerical evolution. I should point out that in the simple model, so lambda phi 4 in 1 plus 1 dimensions, which we'll be considering for the most part in this talk, it's really, this ansatz is not necessary, and we have partial differential equations which we can actually solve by brute force on the computer, which we plan to do eventually. But part of the reason for exploring some of these ideas, which I will get to in this part of the talk, is that we want to see how good or bad simplifying ansatzes are that might help us in higher dimensions, in more complicated theories, where the actual brute force method of solving the evolution equations may not be as easy to use. So then I'll also give you the evolution equations in the simplified ansatz. And finally, I'd like to discuss the future direction we want to take in this work and the issues that we'd really like to understand. So I should mention that this is work in progress, so the focus in this talk is really going to be on setting up the formalism and really trying to bring out all the issues that we want to explore. We don't have any firm conclusions on many of these issues, but we hope to get there soon. So here's the introduction and motivation part of this talk, and in keeping with my grand title, I'm going to sort of step back for a moment and try and place this work in perspective. The aim of this workshop, after all, was to try and bring together different applications by taking a fundamental approach. And so while for the most of the talk I will take this fundamental approach, first, I'd sort of like to mention different potential applications of the specific work we are doing and discussing today. And even before that, actually, I'd like to give a very, very brief review of what we've already achieved in some sense and where we go from here, sort of to place the current work in perspective. So people at this workshop don't need to be reminded that there's been significant activity over the last few years.
On all the participants?
Well, even more than just the participants of this workshop. I've tried to list them in alphabetical order not to offend anybody. The point I wish to make is that there has been significant amount of activity on non-equilibrium quantum field theory, but if you sort of, most of us are familiar with a large fraction of this work, and you can sort of go down the list and convince yourself that, in fact, for the most part, the focus has been on homogeneous non-equilibrium quantum field theory. There are a few exceptions which I'll mention later, but for the large fraction of these papers, it is true that you're discussing homogeneous non-equilibrium quantum field theory. In fact, the two, the few exceptions there are have to do with so there's some real work on non-equilibrium quantum field theory in an inhomogeneous setting, but and there, then there's some work on classical evolution for inhomogeneous fields, but for non-homogeneous quantum field theory is sort of something which we are just starting to explore, and I think that's a fair statement. I'll mention that there are of course some exceptions to that broad brush picture. But first, I mean, just to sort of summarize in some sense what we've achieved so far, there's been work ranging from formal and fundamental work to specific applications in cosmology. Here, I guess the most looked at application has been reheating after inflation. I should also mention that in the context of cosmology, there's electroweak baryogenesis, and there's been a good deal of work that has gone into understanding topological transition rates. And another application which people have in the back of their minds sometimes when they're using this formalism is relativistic heavy ion collisions, and people have looked specifically at formation of disoriented chiral condensates and dileptron production. And for the most part, as I said, it's been homogeneous quantum field theory. I should point out that there are exceptions. Het and Yan have done work on inhomogeneous quantum field theory, and there's also been some earlier work by Poyanovsky, Atanasio, Divega, Holman. I'm not going to read out the names. I mean, some of you may be familiar with some of those papers, so I wanted to mention those just to say that it's not that we're not aware that people are doing inhomogeneous quantum field theory, but it is something which is a little fresh compared to most of the other things that we've seen. And I should point out that inhomogeneous fields have also been studied in classical field theory context, and this has been work done by, for instance, Klebnikov and Tkachev, among others. So, of course, there were good reasons to concentrate first on homogeneous quantum field theory, and I won't go into them, but in many situations, of course, you do need to consider inhomogeneities, and let me just list the reasons why you'd want to do them. First, either you want to establish that inhomogeneities don't play a significant role, but you can only do that if you sort of start off with a formalism in which you have inhomogeneities and then address that issue quantitatively and show that homogeneous quantum field theory is good for these specific applications. But to address that question, you sort of need to have a formalism which has inhomogeneities, and then you can address this issue. In some situations, of course, you're going to find, and you may even expect before you actually do the computation, that inhomogeneities are physically important. And then, of course, you absolutely have to explicitly keep track of inhomogeneities during the time evolution of non-equilibrium quantum fields. Another issue that we sort of want to address is that we want to eventually compare the quantum evolution with the classical evolution, which people have also been doing, to better understand the regime of validity of the classical evolution and determine, where the region of overlap is. Clearly, where the results agree, it may be simpler in some cases to just do the classical evolution, but you want to understand when is that a good approximation and when you want to do the full quantum evolution. So for all these purposes, it is necessary to develop further the general framework for time evolution of inhomogeneous non-equilibrium quantum fields, and then you want to address all these issues one by one. So the specific applications where you expect that inhomogeneities are important are, of course, I think it's clearly an understatement that for relativistic heavy ion collisions, homogeneous fields is a crude approximation. Then for dynamics of topological objects such as kinks and vortices, which are certainly important for condensed matter applications and may well be important for cosmology, for instance, in the context of sphalerons, you certainly, again, need an inhomogeneous formalism. In the early universe, inhomogeneous quantum fields are believed to lead to structure formation, even in the minimal model in which you just assume that inflation somehow was generating these fluctuations. Even there, you want to really sort of start off with a formalism in which you have inhomogeneities at the beginning, at least. So having mentioned these specific applications, of course, I will now turn to a general discussion and set up the formalism for doing time evolution of inhomogeneous fields out of equilibrium. So this was all just to sort of try and, you know, give you what our aims and goals in the long run are. But for the most part in this talk, I will actually be concentrating on the simplest field theory you could think of. The goal is to understand the essential physics here and then generalize to more complicated systems. The world's simplest model, I claim, is scalar field theory, lambda phi 4 in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And that's what we choose to look at first. This model has inhomogeneous kink solutions, and for the moment we're going to concentrate on studying the dynamics of kinks plus inhomogeneous fields about the kinks. Inhomogeneous fluctuations about the kink. So I now want to go through the pathway to the evolution equations for the system. And let me remind you that what we would like to do is to study, we want to keep track of the back reaction of the quantum fluctuations self-consistently and non-perturbatively for inhomogeneous quantum fields. And so we'll need the Hartree evolution equations. And so what I'm going to describe now is the pathway to follow to arrive at the Hartree evolution equations. So if you start off with a general Lagrangian of this form, then you decompose the field phi in terms of the inhomogeneous mean field and the fluctuations. You decompose the potential in terms of the even and odd powers of psi, the fluctuation field. You then go and impose the Hartree factorization, which consists of replacing the even part by V of phi plus psi square times m square, where m square is given by this expression here. You evaluate this derivative and then evaluate it phi plus psi. And similarly, the odd part is replaced by psi times nu, where nu is evaluated by evaluating this derivative and then setting phi equal to phi plus psi. I will go through this for a specific form of the potential here, so we will have explicit expressions for these for the case we are interested in.
Mm. We throw away the psi to the fourth term.
Yes.
That's usually part of Hartree, I suppose, but
yes.
Could you also keep them? I presented this, I kept them because why not? But why not do it better even?
Well, I mean, So I guess the question is that you could try and do better than this by trying to keep the four-point function and
in a Gaussian ensemble, you know what the answer will be.
As long as you're doing the whole thing self-consistently, I don't see any problem with that. I mean, of course, you have to make sure that you're being self-consistent. And for what I'm going to be doing is just keeping, this factorization and then being self-consistent with this factorization. In principle...
In detail, the psi can be a standard in Morse function.
Yes.
Where the coefficients are creation and annihilation operators.
Yes.
Which are independent of time.
Yes.
And then they give the initial conditions. Their correlations correspond to the initial conditions.
Uh-huh.
And if that's a Gaussian initial condition, then you can evaluate any power of psi that way.
Well,
that's what Hartree does. That's what
right.
I
that's, but
I think that's what he's doing. Because what m square also depends on psi.
Right. I mean, well, let me show the explicit form of the evolution equations, and maybe this issue will be clearer. I mean, I'm not sure I understand your question exactly. Yeah, it is Hartree I'm doing. I'm not sure. Really. Right. Yeah, I'm sorry. It should have a 1/2 in there. So Okay, so if you do the Hartree factorization, then you'll arrive at the evolution equations, which are of this form. And now I'll look at the specific form of the potential here. It's basically lambda phi 4, and the only reason for writing down explicitly is that in literature, various different forms of lambda phi 4 are written down, and you know, I want to be specific about it so that you know, all the, you can compare the coefficients across different papers. So for that form of the potential, you can explicitly write down nu and m square, and notice that these involve psi square, which are the fluctuations, the two-point functions, which can be evaluated in terms of mode functions. And for the rest of the, you know, this transparency and part of the next one, I just want to sort of give in detail, you know, the justification for using this two-point function in terms of the mode functions, and just to make things absolutely explicit. And so, for instance, as Jan was saying, you can expand the psi field and the momentum operator conjugate to it in terms of creation and annihilation operators and the mode functions in this way. Then you use the commutation relations for the A's and A daggers. And then if you use the canonical commutation relation between psi and pi, then requiring that gives you a condition on the mode functions. And the condition on the mode functions that you get is this, written down here. So if you then use this condition together with the fact that the psi satisfy this differential equation, it's then straightforward to show that the Green's function constructed out of the mode functions in this way satisfies the appropriate differential equation. So you can now collect together all the evolution equations which form a complete set and can be self-consistently evolved forward in time. And here is, in fact, all the equations gathered together so you can view them at one point. There's nothing new here. It's just that I wanted to point out that this does form a complete set of evolution equations, which, given a consistent, well-defined initial conditions, you can time step forward and get a well-defined evolution from there. Sorry. The m square, they depend on the mode functions through this term psi square, which is involves the mode sum here. Well, I'm not sure the third order equation for psi. I mean, this evolution equation is second order in time for psi.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Factorize.
What do you call it? Factorize.
Well, there are the brackets around it.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're actually doing the time evolution, you don't need to consider third time derivatives. I mean, that's, I guess, the point. I mean, you can just. The point is that you evaluate this, you know, you have an initial condition at some, and then at any, so at any given time, you go to either the initial conditions if it's the initial time, or you go to the previous time step if it's not the initial time, and you have actually this explicit expression for m squared in terms of the mode functions, so you have this as, you know, some function of x and t, and then you use that to, the information from the previous time step or from the initial conditions to time step forward. Okay, so of course you need to provide a consistent set of initial conditions for evolving those evolution equations forward, and one way of getting, you know, consistent inhomogeneous initial conditions is by looking at the static problem, and that way you're sort of guaranteed that at least in X at a given time slice your initial data is consistent. And so it's useful to consider static inhomogeneous equations to give you a consistent set of initial conditions. But you did you
already what you mean by consistent initial conditions?
Well, what I mean basically is that it should, you know, so for instance, you have the time slip, this is time slice at t equal to zero. On that time slice, it should satisfy the differential equation that it is supposed to satisfy.
In space.
Yes, in space also, yes. And then when you evolve.
Why can't you just say I choose the momenta and coordinates independently at t equals zero in the Hamilton sense, or I say I have a field and its first time derivative. I can choose it any way you like. Why is there a consistency condition?
Well, if you don't. I mean, so if you choose, for instance, initial conditions which, for instance, don't satisfy at t equal to zero the equations that, you know, for over x, then what's going to happen is that in your first time, you know, first few time steps here, you know, the all your mode functions and your fields are going to try and just, you know, the. Well, so you could choose. Any initial conditions you like, but then initially you're going to get, you know, some behavior which is transient and reflects your initial conditions more than, so we have a specific, you know, question we want to look at. Yeah, we have a specific question in mind which we wish to address.
It leads you to use the word consistent, but in a mathematical sense, I think the only thing that's necessary
is a complete set.
Yeah.
And
you have normalized in some way, and then you go ahead. The phenomenon you're describing is a physical phenomenon. It doesn't do with mathematical concepts.
Well, sure. I mean, in a sense, it was motivated by physics that, you know, yes, you could look at, you know, transient phenomena, but, you know, our, you know, at least for the moment, our goal was not to sort of look at transient phenomena associated with just specific initial conditions, but sort of so it is motivated by a specific physical process that we wanted to study.
Is it that you want the initial condition to be already some kind of eigenstate of the Hartree Hamiltonian?
Well, we want it to be close to a solution of the Hartree evolution equations, and then perturb it in some specific way so that we watch the response of the system to that specific way of perturbing it, if you like.
So, how are you guaranteeing that you have a complete set of modes if it's homogeneous?
Oh, I mean, for this particular problem, in particular, I mean, so for the specific application we have in mind, the static problem, for instance, can be solved and you get a complete basis for the problem. And then once you have that complete basis, you can expand all your quantities in terms of that complete basis.
Are you going to tell us about how you find that complete basis?
Sure.
So sorry for
interrupting. No. Go ahead.
So this conceptually, I want to get used to it. That second equation
there, uh-huh.
Is that kind of eigen equation for the state of the Hartree Hamiltonian?
Yes, basically.
It's a nonlinear equation, but it still gives you the eigen state.
Exactly.
That's the solution of the static problem.
I see, but I want the interpretation in the quantum Hilbert space. What is its interpretation there? Go and say back. You have a Hartree approximation, so you have a Hartree Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So you can then say, what are its eigenstates?
Yes, okay.
Well, I don't know if that's a good way to say it, because Hartree is a bit funny already, but compared to the original quantum field theory, you are approximating the eigenstates of. You're trying to find approximate eigenstates of the original Hamiltonian as initial conditions.
Yes, but you said it, I think, right the first time. These are eigenstates of the Hartree Hamiltonian. Yes, and this is this is an inhomogeneous mean field with some fluctuations.
Yeah, they will not differ, I can say.
Which are, you know, the phonon dressing was Grant talked about yesterday, right? Because the, these are the modes are excited around that.
Right.
That configuration, and they have to have that form. I think that's what you mean by consistent. You just have to satisfy the static equation. And they have to be a complete or not necessarily orthonormal, but these are can be made orthonormal.
It's a choice of initial conditions.
So the first problem that one can solve is the status problem before you even think about time evolution. Then you can take this as a starting point. Be sure that it's a consistent starting point to begin time evolution. Right.
So that's how you're going to take care of it. I see, yeah. It's trivial with the group set of modes in a static case, but in the non-static case, it's not trivial.
So you can always use the static mode as a basis set if you want to.
Right.
And, sure
and then you're okay.
Right. So that was. So that's what we're planning to do, and I will show this, you know, I can show this basis set explicitly, but I'll get to that later. First, I actually wanted to discuss renormalization, if that's okay with you guys. I'll talk to you. So the reason, of course, for doing renormalization is that if you consider the bare Hartree equations, then this involves a mode sum which is divergent in the form it's written. And so you need to do renormalization to take care of this issue. And you can do this by demanding that your system of equations possess a static homogeneous solution for phi. That is, you ask that phi is equal to phi naught is equal to a constant not equal to zero, with the corresponding mode functions given by psi n, which are of this form, u and x, and omega n actually appeared on the previous transparency. So this was the eigenvalue corresponding to this eigenfunction of the static problem. So in particular, u and x has a form that some of you may have seen before. This is in a box of length L. And of course, because we are going to impose periodic boundary conditions on a box of length L, Kn take on these specific values. The mode functions satisfy the differential equation written down here, now explicitly written in terms of using all the parameters that we are interested in, lambda, mu square, and omega n square. So if you looked at the first equation, which was the field equation, then using these forms for the field and the modes, you can show that if the field has to satisfy this constraint. And if phi naught is not equal to zero, then you get a relationship between lambda, mu, and your mode sum, and phi naught. So then you also look at the mode equation simultaneously, then you get another constraint on the various parameters here. If you choose to write omega n in this form, kn squared plus m squared, then where kn was just this quantity, then the quantity m squared is related to phi naught, mu, and the mode sum by this relationship. And now if you compare this equation with this equation, you can actually show that m, lambda, and phi naught have to satisfy that relationship. So doing some more algebra, I guess the point I wanted to get to basically is that you can do some algebra and express the parameter mu in terms of m, lambda, and the mode sums, and then you want to go back to your bare equations and substitute for this expression in your bare expressions, and then you will explicitly see that it takes the form. For instance, for the mode functions, the explicit form is written down here, and now notice that your mode sum, there's an explicit subtraction. So if you define the renormalized fluctuations in this way, then you can write the equations compactly in this form. So here's the equation for phi, and here is the equation for the mode functions. And so now you have an explicit subtraction, which you can carry out and make sure that your quantities are well-defined. So having renormalized, we can now do the time evolution. The full time evolution, of course, requires the solution of PDEs, which is something we want to do. But you can, for a number of reasons, which I will again list for you later, we want to simplify the problem by making an ansatz which is physically motivated and which we expect to be a good approximation for some finite time. So to do that, let's consider first the static problem. So for the static problem, you'll have some solutions which will be a specific function of x for phi, and which will be another specific function for the mode functions, where qn is just this expression, and then un is just a function of x. So just for concreteness, so you know that these things can be written down. In the limit that lambda h bar upon m square goes to zero in our evolution equations, here are explicit functions that you can, in this case, write down analytically. And so in this case, sigma of x is just related to m and square root lambda by this expression. And these are, so for that case, you know, the spectrum looks like you have one omega equal to zero mode, one, so there are these two discrete modes with the specific eigenvalues, and then there is a continuum of modes with q being a continuum index. And it has this eigenvalue, and the eigenfunctions are of this form. The reason for putting these squiggles is basically that there's a normalization factor in front of these functions, which I haven't bothered to write down, but which we have computed, and it's principle straightforward to write down. I just didn't want to overload the transparency. So the point is that, given the static problem, you can actually have an explicit function of x for these quantities. And once you have an explicit function for these quantities, then you can make this ansatz that your phi at time t not equal to zero is sigma of x minus x of t, where x of t is now some function of time. And similarly, your mode functions are now qn of t times un x minus xt, where xt is the same function of time.
So is it e to the I omega n?
No, you're going to let it evolve self-consistently. Yeah.
And the little q is a discrete set.
Little q being this q here. If you were working in the finite L, it's discrete, but if you take the continuum limit, then it's continuous. So if you substitute this ansatz into the Hartree evolution equations, you of course will realize that you essentially convert the PDEs to ODEs, which will be easier to solve. And this, may be particularly useful in going to higher dimensions. I mean, as Jan was pointing out in his talk, or maybe Hert in his talk, that these PDEs, while you can actually explicitly solve them in 1 plus 1 dimensions, as you go to higher dimensions, it's going to get to be a nastier problem computationally. And so you want to explore ways of, simplifying the problem by using some physical intuition, and of course you want to check that your physical intuition isn't leading you astray. So in particular, in this specific case, we can actually do both the time evolution using the full PDEs, and then you can also compare the solutions that you get by doing the time evolution using this ansatz, which results in ODEs. And then by comparing this, the first question you'd like to answer, of course, is how long it's a good approximation to use this ansatz. One expects physically that there's going to be some finite time for which it's reasonable that, while the profiles, if you like, the profiles of all these functions, while they're not changing significantly, you expect that ansatz to be good. Once the profiles have changed significantly, you don't expect that ansatz to be good. And so you want to check, you know, what's the region of time for which I can believe that ansatz. And once you believe that, you can actually also try to understand physically where the time scale is coming from in terms of the parameters of your model. So the goal of doing these two things, of course, would be that if you understand that, then you can hope that when you go to higher dimensions where the numerical problem is going to be nastier, then you can hope to make some progress quickly by using a similar ansatz if you understand the physical time scale on which you expect that ansatz to be valid and you know when it's going to break down.
The application is really that you have kings which are colliding.
Well, actually, the first problem we choose to study. It is the simplest problem you could think of studying, which is the one kink problem. But in principle, you could do a similar thing for multi kink solutions, and actually, that's one of the things we'd like to get to once we are done with the one kink thing.
So the ansatz depends on what physics is.
Right, right. So you want to use your physical intuition to set up some ansatz, you know, of that nature, and then. Okay, you're referring to the fact that if you have periodic boundary conditions, you essentially have a multi-kink solution, if you like, and there the multi-kink solution has an instability that will cause all of them to annihilate and go away. That's what you're referring to, I guess. So yes, so I mean, so if you actually look at the spectrum for these mode equations that I wrote down in finite L, you see that there is one eigenvalue which is negative and which corresponds precisely to that instability that you were mentioning. I mean, so when you look at these in the periodic, for the periodic L, then these equations are Lamé equations, it turns out, and there's, you know, well-known differential equations which actually, you know, so in fact, Emil in one day just went through this entire literature and showed, you know, exactly the value of that negative eigenvalue, and that in the limit L going to infinity, that negative eigenvalue actually, you know, went away. So physically, we want to take the L equal to infinity limit, and that's where we expect this thing to be stable, and that's where we want to study this problem, really. Basically. Right, exactly. I think that's the physical picture. Okay, so since, in fact, I guess you guys are always a step ahead of me, so you were you were asking me questions about the specific problem, and the specific problem we choose to study is take a kink and self-consistent fluctuations about the kink, and then what we'd like to do is to give the kink a kick, say to the right, and watch how it evolves as it interacts with the Barth fluctuations. So for this, the initial conditions will be at t equal to 0, your qn's will be taken to be this. So in fact, these things are, you know, straightforward initial conditions. The only non-trivial initial conditions which is actually going to cause it to time evolve, really, is the fact that you give the kink a kick by having a non-zero value of v0. So before doing numerical evolution, then, you want to put your equations in a dimensionless form, which we choose to do in this way, rescaling the field, the coupling constant, x, and so on. And so the dimensionless equations are of that form. And then, of course, these are equations in terms of phi. There should be a phi twiddle there, I'm sorry. Then, of course, you know, you can use the chain rule. It's an algebra, essentially, to express your evolution equations in terms of time derivatives on x. And then, of course, for doing the explicit time evolution, you want to split your q into its real and imaginary parts. So you have evolution equations for x, q real part of k, q imaginary part of k. And the reason for giving these dots is not that we don't know how to compute the right-hand side. It's just that it's a meshy expression, and just to prove that we've done it, Here is actually the explicit expression for QKFR, Stein evolution, and actually to get the equation in this form, you have to do a little trick, because you want to take your mode evolution equation and multiply it by UKR, and then the so there were two mode equations if you write them in terms of its real and imaginary parts. You multiply the first one by UKR, the second one by UKI, where UKR and I are the imaginary parts of UK, and then you add and subtract, so you'll get one equation for QK of R and another one for QK of I, which you know look fairly symmetrical, so and I'm pretty sure you're not going to read these, so I'm just going to flash them up and just tell you that you can actually just explicitly write down what these evolution equations are in terms of these functions, and then you just have to go and feed this into a code. Sorry. Sure.
Sure. You've got total and partial derivatives up there. Is that what you want?
Okay, so let me explain that point. So these partial derivatives are essentially, so let me write them down here. So UK, well, so for the purposes here, you don't really need to split it into its imaginary and real parts if you're going to do it on a blackboard. So here's your form for UK of X and T.
So capital X of T is where the kink is?
Yes, the capital X of T is where the kink center is as a function of time. So now this is just, you know, this is just some function. So you can, for the purpose of evaluating these partial derivatives, you can forget, if you like, that x was a function of time, and evaluate these quantities explicitly, right? I mean, you can just do that explicitly. So these are just some expressions, if you like, which you're not going to be, you know, evolving in time in any real sense. You know, all you're going to do is that given at any time the value of x of t, it is going to pull that, you know, plug that value of x and t in there, and then you have this expression explicitly, you know.
Those functions are known functions?
Yes.
Those are the functions of the zero lambda k?
Okay, so depending on whether you're doing the, you know, so for the zero lambda case, these things are actually things you can write down analytically.
Is that what you're using?
Well, so in fact, let me be explicit. So for doing the first round of numerical evolution, what I'm going to do is look at the weak coupling regime, where you can actually just use the analytic expressions as an approximation, but you don't need to do that, right? In principle, you could solve the full problem for non-zero eta, at the static problem, and that will give you some specific function of x for all these quantities at the value of eta that you choose. And so once you have those, then you can just use those to do the time evolution for any specific value of eta. So the only simplification in the eta going to zero limit is that you have an analytic expression, but in the eta not equal to zero limit, you'll have some explicit expression which you may not be able to write down in a simple closed form, but there are expressions which, you know, you can certainly...
If I use the exact static function,
right,
the finite value of the coupling, would I not just have a translational invariant solution with your initial condition?
So...
Lorentz invariant?
Yeah.
I was just asking.
Yeah.
There does exist, of course, you know, Lorentz invariance in the problem, translation invariance in the problem, and so that's there. So I mean, if you were to take, let's see, so you had your phi x, minus x of t, and so if you were to take both your mode functions and your classical field and translate them by the same amount, then you would get another solution that would be satisfying the differential equations. Now,
That's not what you're doing.
That's not what I'm doing. That's
so how is it different from what you're doing?
So here I choose... So here I choose your functions, so these are some given functions initially as a function of x, and I substitute these in, and...
But are they solutions of a static problem or not?
The initial functions are solutions of the static problem, but they are not necessarily solutions of the...
The right static.
Of the right static problem, if you like, or you could have in your mind there'd be different initial conditions for different time steps in some sense. Well, I mean,
I think what you do is that you take the static problem and then complete the step, then you give the king a kick, but the quantum fluctuations, if I look at your initial conditions, are just the initial condition for the three quantum fluctuations.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is the king moves and the quantum fluctuations are a bit behind. That's how it looks like.
Yeah, so
in this case, you would do this substitution and everything is moving at the same speed. But now you just have a static solution, you give the king a kick, and then the quantum fluctuations will react to that.
No, but there's no kick. I mean, it's just a boost.
Well, I'm not boosting. I'm not... Okay.
It's a boosted static problem.
Yeah.
Which is in a way equivalent
to the real thing. If you solve the static problem for a given value of the coupling, and then you take an initial condition, which is just a boosted static problem with the same value of the coupling, then by Lorentz invariance, you should get just the
initial
goes along.
Initial condition which we wrote down is not a boost.
But that's why I'm asking you what the functions are, because otherwise, you know, in this maze, we're going to lose the physics.
So,
okay, maybe you should go on.
So I mean, the point of, let me just say once briefly, is that you're not kicking the mode functions at the same time with the same velocity, if you like. You're kicking at an initial time just the zero mode, not the mode functions. And then you're just letting the mode functions react.
Okay, here you have uk of x minus x.
Right.
So the mode functions, which are moving too, not just the mean field.
They're moving, but now you're going to let them evolve self-consistently, if you like.
Yeah, but I know there is a self-consistent solution, which is just a boosted static kink. So that must be a solution of the equations, otherwise I've gone wrong somewhere, right?
I think you should put down the initial conditions you
have. Yeah, I mean...
For me, that must be your...
Okay.
Let's go back to it after.
Okay, of course, one point I should mention is that the equation didn't look simpler to the human eye, and but the point I want to make is that they are simpler for the computer because they involve integrating ODEs, not PDEs. They're simpler than if you were not to make the sound system to evolve those PDEs in time. So, of course, physically we expect the ansatz to be good for some finite time, while the profiles in space don't get significantly modified. And in this regime, we can meaningfully talk about the motion of the king center and its velocity and extract this physical information from the solution to the equations using above ansatz. So the code is written, and I'm analyzing the results. I'm still, still in the process of doing that. Since I don't understand all the numbers that are coming out, I've decided not to, go into the specific numbers that I'm getting at the moment. Yes.
But so you're using the sound system that's going to break down, presumably meaning you're not going to have some sort of self-consistent equation.
No. Physically, I think the solution you get to this equation, this is expectation at this point. Physically, what I expect is that after some point, the evolution you get from this equation is not going to track the full evolution that you're going to get by just solving the PDEs by brute force. And so when those two deviate, of course, the one that you're going to trust is the solution from the PDEs. And that's going to tell you that in some sense your ansatz isn't tracking the physics anymore.
There must be some other way to determine that, though.
And I'd be happy to hear about those.
Well, I mean, for example, if you try to do this in gravity, which you're not, but you find, you try an offset like this, and you might get one equation that worked or something, one equation that you could solve, but then you find the stress tensor wasn't conserved.
So yeah, in fact, actually, so we want to make checks of that kind and make sure that at least those kinds of things aren't getting violated. I mean, clearly, if those kinds of things get violated, then...
Well, nothing has to get violated.
Well, I'm a bit confused, I admit, because if you just substitute that form into the equation and satisfy the same equation, how can you be wrong? And you started with some set of equations, you substituted this form, you plugged it in, and now you have a new set of equations. It's just a change of variables. So if I really solve those equations, I'm really solving the same equation in a different set of variables. Can it be wrong?
I think it can be in the sense that you're making, I think, an ansatz here about the fact that your profiles, if you like, for the classical...
So you're not solving some equation.
You're
the equation for the profile has to be solved also.
Right. So what I'm saying. Yes. 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 So basically what I'm.
That wasn't clear.
Oh. Okay. So that I should mention that you know, in some sense this is a truncation where you're sort of saying that the profile isn't changing, and just the center, if you like.
But that means you threw away the equation for the mean field.
No. That doesn't mean that.
Truncating the sum of
At what point did one throw away a term?
Well, I didn't throw away a term. The point is that. I don't think it's just a change of variables because.
How many modes do you say it's
got one of
the other? We plan to keep tens of thousands of modes, and I mean that's what I have right now. But, you know. So those are the kinds of issues that I want to look at, and I haven't really finished looking at whether you look at. But I mean, I don't see a problem numerically with keeping tens of thousands of modes.
But on the other hand, you haven't gained anything by changing from finding different modes to the mode extension.
Well,
mode extension might be a simple thing to do. By solving the 10 modes, you can do a lot better than you had if you had a grid of 10 points, which is likely to work, right? But if you have to solve 10,000 modes, you may as well just have solved with 10,000 grid points.
So in fact, actually...
Yeah, but the modes are themselves function of 10,000 points, so it's 10,000 squared, so...
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the point. I mean, that if you were to actually solve the PDEs, then you'd have to do more than just. And I guess the point is that in 1+1 dimensions, you know, it's you could do it either way, and then you'd probably get. But as you go to higher and higher dimensions, you'd need fewer in this way of doing it than in the other way of doing
that's
it.
That's the hope, right?
That's the hope.
I mean, because these modes are matched to the problem.
Exactly.
Rather than just some blind.
You really believe that your solution looks like it thinks, so why not?
Right.
One would expand the solution
right.
In that form.
But I do think this is, I mean, you can do it either way if you'd like to finish what you want to say, and then we can come back after a coffee break, or you can do it now as you wish. Just to understand exactly what the approximation is.
Okay, so
at the moment it looks like a change of variable.
Okay, so let me try and address it now, and if it, you know, so you have, you know, some sigma of x which you get from the static problem, and here's x, and you know, here's sigma of x.
The static problem at zero coupling, or
no. Well, eventually, I mean, what we'd want to do is have the static problem at at some specific value of eta. So that you have this profile, and now what the ansatz is saying is just take this function, okay? This is some, you know, for simplicity, I'm just going to, okay. So for simplicity, I'm going to write down this specific form, which is actually valid only in...
Yes, that's valid only when we don't couple the modes back to...
Right.
That's the classical kink.
Right. So
is
but
that
it,
the function you're going to use?
No, but I'm just writing it down for... Okay, so if you like, let me keep these things in brackets. Let me keep these things in brackets so, you know, for people who like to see explicit expressions. I mean, it's going to be some expression which is different, but there is some explicit expression that you can actually write down as a function of x.
Why explicit expression? It's a numeric, it's a solution of a numerical problem itself. It's that itself.
But you could certainly, for instance, take that numerical... solution and plot it as a function of x, and you would have some profile.
Sure, but not an explicit function.
Well, that's what I mean by an explicit expression, right. that you have something which
right.
you can tell the computer here is something as a function of x.
Right.
So now what I would like to do is to say that the shape of this thing is not changing as a function of time. That's an ansatz.
So if it's an ansatz, I must be violating some equation by using that ansatz.
Yes.
So that means I have to be throwing away some terms at some point. Are there some terms that I throw away?
So in fact, you're throwing away something. I mean, it's not in the...
So we're trying to understand what.
You're throwing away, you know, for instance, anything which has to do with the modification of the profile to say something like that.
Are you throwing away the equation for the classical field?
I'm not going to...
That's what I said.
Yeah.
No.
We are interested in the algebra at this point.
Okay, so you're not... So in fact, actually, no. So when you... So you just take this sigma, which was some explicit function of x, and then you substitute in your mode equation, which was some differential operator acting on sigma.
So you write phi is equal to this definite function. Sigma of x minus capital X.
Right.
But the point is, phi is not equal to that in general.
Right. That's the point.
So you neglect the best reaction.
You neglect something. You neglect. You're not really solving the same equation.
You're not really solving the same equation, and that's why I keep saying that
but
you want.
Then you have, but which equation are you neglecting then? The equation for the classical field phi.
You actually have a form. Okay, so you actually have an equation for sigma in which you could substitute the explicit form you had for sigma, and that would give you some evolution equation for x of t. It's not the but it's not, you know, once you've made this ansatz, you've thrown away anything which has to do with the shape change in the shape of the profile of the mean field.
But then that can't be a solution to the complete classical equation.
It's an approximation to the solution.
Yeah, so therefore you're not solving the complete classical.
You're not solving the complete, yes. You're not solving the complete classical equation in this ansatz. So the way to solve the complete classical equation would be actually to solve the PDE.
No, but how do you derive the equation for x?
So you derive the equation for x by taking this explicit thing, then just using that,
plug it in,
and you'll get some equation for x, which is not, I repeat, the exact, you know.
But how is that possible?
Yeah.
You have a partial differential equation.
Uh-huh.
With space and time.
Right.
X only depends on time. So how can you satisfy the spatial part of the
way? Okay, in practice...
The little x
Yeah,
how can you satisfy that equation for all little x?
Yeah.
So for all little x, that may be one way to check this ansatz is that you have to choose, in actually doing your evolution, you have to choose a specific value of x at which you choose to do the evolution. And if you choose different values of x, as long as you're getting a consistent answer, you would trust this.
You get for each little x, you have a different equation for capital X.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're fixing little x, and then you're getting an ordinary differential.
Yeah, you're getting an ordinary differential equation, and in fact, one way to choose the consistent.
Or you can integrate over x.
Right, but so the point would be to
it wasn't quick. Is that what you're doing?
Yes.
You're
yes.
Integrating over x.
No, I'm just choosing a specific value of x.
For little x.
For choosing a specific value for little x.
And then you choose all of them.
So that's the thing I want to check is that if I choose different values of x, do I get consistent evolutions or not? If I don't get consistent evolution, well, so presumably those are going to be close to each other for some time, and for that time you can trust those the evolution solution you're getting. And then once they're not close together, then you shouldn't trust those solutions.
I understand that in general, but now we come back to the Lorentz
theorem.
Mm-hmm. If I have really used the static solution for a given coupling.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe that I will satisfy the exact equation for all x if I just boost my static solution.
You would certainly satisfy the exact equation. But here we're making a truncation, if you like. We're making this approximation.
Truncation will be correct for exactly that case. You take the initial condition, just boost it. Because you don't change the profile by boosting the static solution.
You do actually. The gamma factor in the denominator is the shape of the kink. So it's like the diagram you just drew. The moving kink has a slightly different shape.
Less well known.
Okay, but you could easily
so
put that
you
in.
So you can expand it in the same sort of mode you've used, but it's a non-trivial sum.
But I could put the gamma factor in.
Do some different, something cleverer, because you can't see the gamma factor by solving a static solution, because the gamma factor is a velocity.
Yeah.
So you only see the static solution plus derivations of that.
So you have to solve the boosted.
You have to solve some different solution and devise some different set of profiles.
But the equation one writes down should have boost invariance, right? So I ought to be able. For a static solution, you ought to be able to generate a boosted solution for any velocity.
You can go to the reference frame of the kink.
Yeah. Right.
All
yeah. And that's what that's all this is doing. Right?
There should be some way to do that.
Yeah.
But this classical way, this normal way of doing it, it's not obvious how to do it. But if you're solving a static problem, so there's no concept of what gamma is.
It should just be a reference frame. That shouldn't reduce it into the rest. Just the Lorentz transformation is straightforward, little x and t.
I think so.
And substitute it in.
Right.
That should be the answer. Mm-hmm.
So there should be a boosted solution. And if you choose this profile and choose that initial condition, then you should just find that solution, nothing else. And this approximation that you call it would be actually exact.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't broken Lorentz invariance in the equation, right?
Sure.
But I'm not really sure if it's really, really substituting this in both the kink and in the mean.
If you use a given function and don't boost it, like the gamma factor, if you just neglect gamma, then of course it won't be the correct profile. Yeah.
It would be a good thing to do.
To exhibit Lorentz invariance and show that if you start with that initial condition, which is x just has velocity, that you also have an exact solution.
I think that the fluctuations are not boosted.
It's a vacuum.
We have these talks in Utrecht about people solving nonlinear equation and having these wave processes. So this method of solution is used very often. It's like fast and slow variables and slow variables.
I mean, I think the issue is if you can write down an orthogonal set of coordinates in which the boost, the translation is orthogonal to all these modes, then you should be perfectly free to boost the thing and boost all the modes.
Apart from boosting, there's a more general, as a general way of solving things analytically. Get some consistent equation, approximate equation for those x variables, and maybe.
In the limit of, yeah.
For any kind of set equation.
When they're slowly moving. Yeah, but what I'm saying is that you ought not to have to make that approximation at this level.
Not
I think for the problem is that.
Okay, so there are clearly issues that you know we need to understand better, but basically the issues that you know the physics issues that we'd like to address eventually is to study kink dynamics. I mean, so either by solving the full PDEs or by making some suitable ansatz, and once we have solutions to our evolution equations for the kink dynamics. We want to compare to earlier work done in this field and also applications to specific condensed matter systems. For instance, there's been some work done on kink dynamics by Schrieffer et al. And Bishop et al. That we sort of would like to compare our work to. They use different techniques, and so we'd like to see how our work compares with that and whether we have anything to say in that context. That's the kind of thing they looked at, yes. So another thing that we wish to look at is, whether the fluctuations on different length scales of different K, is there any significant movement of fluctuations from one scale to another as you do the time evolution? So one issue which we would like to address is you could do two different evolutions, one just using the classical evolution equations, and then you could do the quantum inhomogeneous field with quantum back reaction taken into account, and then you want to compare those two evolutions and see where they give similar results, when is it good to make a classical approximation, and when you really do need to study the quantum problem. As I already mentioned at some point in the talk, once we understand the dynamics of the single kink, we want to study multi-kink solutions and the time evolution of multi-kink solutions. Eventually, of course, we want to generalize this to higher dimensions, study in particular things like dynamics of vortices. And once we've done that, we want to study applications of things like that. For instance, dynamics of vortices are important in the condensed matter context. And once we've finished all that, we'll find other interesting things to do and do them. Yeah. That's all I have to say.
It's basically modulist things that end up what you're doing in your approximation. But people have done with monopoles. Mark Gold has written this very nice plan to try this effective, beautiful theory, symmetric accommodation. So the philosophy of the position of some solid or classical object satisfies its own equation in some analytic approximation.
It's approximation. Yeah. The mass of the thing goes like one of the couplings. It's called velocity small.
Yeah.
And the general formulation doesn't make that restriction. But when you start making these ansatz, unless you satisfy. In principle, you could satisfy the equations exactly by a change of variables, then you're not restricted to that. But then you have to allow the profile to change.
Yeah, but then in the interacting case, two kings, so it becomes again an approximation.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it depends on what
you implement. Single kings, you can just boost, but two kings, they collide, and so
sure.
Then
you have to solve the profile function if it's a new function. Right? You can't just assume it will stick by the static problem.
Yeah, but I think the whole ansatz is then only in approximation.
Well,
in the multi-king case.
I could imagine making a change of variables to some other profile function that then satisfies the equation exactly. But that's not what he was doing here.
No, but in multi-kink case, you have sort of scattering of the fluctuations on the kink.
You right? want to keep those, you don't want to throw them away.
Right.
Is there anything like when you're accelerating kink in the classical solution, so that you wouldn't, any classical solution that would correspond to that, so that you mean, the Lorentz invariance is interesting and you work out, but it's also trivial at the same time. Although, I mean, you could play games with, you know, trying to learn how to do the partial differential solutions to the equations, because you know analytically in some sense what they are.
Accelerator can't quite when the solved equation is even possible.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if there was anything non-trivial, so it wouldn't...
It came from some elementary excitation, which bounds over the definite over.
So the quantum back reaction.
It's like a laser hitting the king.
No, some interesting questions that one... When this is all stringed out, it would be interesting, for example, if instead of taking the vacuum, you take a thermal bath and then put the velocity on it, and of course it's not there, and you would expect to see the thing slow down, so the damping rate would be related to the diffusion constant. You think of this as a big, heavy Brownian particle going through some bath, and so that would should be adjusted within this framework. Not exactly there.
But is there a considerable window where the room needs to take one effect into account?
Well, it's controlled by that parameter, which is you wrote it down coupling in the
lambda h bar upon m squared, I guess.
Depends on which physical system.
Right, but if you think about the finite temperature situation, then normally we think of a temperature which is much lower than the ink can.
Yeah.
In physical application.
And then you would think of a temperature which is much higher than the elementary excitation.
If it's strongly self-coupled, but the temperature is lower than the kink energy, much lower than the kink energy.
Then the dielectric mass flow.
If the temperature is lower
than the kink energy.
Much lower than the kink energy.
But nevertheless,
much higher than the phonon.
Right, but nevertheless,
H bar omega is the order of KT, this is quantum, right?
Okay, this is
right.
This elementary omega. Yes, what Alex said. Temperature lower than the kink energy, but higher than the elementary, except the energy of the elementary excitation.
Yeah.
That would be less. That would be
fine.
But there are relays. The kink energy of order M or so, kink mass.
No, there's an extra power of the coupling. You have all the formulas. You have three scales.
You have
the energy of the kink, you have the fluctuation, and then you have temperature. So when these two things are of the same order of the world, that's the quantum. R3 wouldn't be valid unless this is small compared to that.
So anyway, that's all I had to say.